Okay. So, last time, again, just to set expectations, right? This is meant to be a tutorial on asymptotic methods as they might be used in the context of this program. And so, you know, primarily that means as applied to differential equations, ultimately PDEs. Last week we talked about the method of multiple scales, and in my humble opinion, there's sort of two broad kingdoms of asymptotic methods for differential equations. There are a bazillion variants on these themes, and they get reinvented and things like that. But in my experience, really you can categorize the methodologies as either the method of multiple scales or the method of matched asymptotics. Multiple scales is appropriate when you have physical processes acting on disparate time and or space scales, but sort of simultaneously. So a slowly modulated wave is a classic example. And the example we did in class last week was a weakly damped mass spring oscillator. So if this is time and this is the displacement of the mass, you know, there's some fast oscillation, but there's also this slower decay time scale associated with the weak damping, right? But these processes are acting simultaneously, but they have disparate scales. And so the key sort of technical ideas were you actually have to introduce formally into the mathematics, you know, two times instead of one, which at first seems perhaps strange if you haven't done this before. And only at the end of the analysis do you say, oh yeah, there's really only one time. Again, technically, the key thing was suppressing those secular terms. That's what gave us the amplitude equation, and more generally, imposing some sort of solvability that ensures that your asymptotic expansion will stay uniformly valid or uniformly asymptotic over the sufficiently long time or space scales that you care about. So that source of singularity or non-uniformity in that case typically is a semi-infinite domain. So in time, for example, you know, we might be interested in the solution not just for a couple of oscillations, but over very long times. If you just do a regular perturbation expansion, you just get a small quantitative tweak to your prediction that will be useless after. It'll just give you horrible predictions, you know, out at large time. Or if you just did the epsilon equals zero problem, no damping, you know, when you're out here, you still predict you've got a wave of unit amplitude or an oscillation, whereas maybe you have almost no amplitude left. Okay, so it's really the semi-infinite time domain, or that's the problem there. In the method of matched asymptotics, the source of non-uniformity actually can also be semi-infinite domains. And a classic example for those of you in the know is Stokes' flow of low Reynolds number flow past a sphere. So then actually, you know, that problem really is handled with the method of matched asymptotics, with the source of non-uniformity being, you know, a very big domain, okay, relative to the size of the sphere. But more often, it's the hallmark, you know, warning sign is that the differential equation changes type, or at least its order, when you set epsilon equal to zero. And so this is classic boundary layer analysis, okay? So here would be the signal that I have in mind, where now I'm thinking probably space instead of time, and there's some function that maybe changes very rapidly close to a boundary, right? And then changes more smoothly away from the boundary. Okay, so again, we have maybe different physical processes that are important, okay, giving rise to different scales. But in the method of matched asymptotics that we'll be discussing today, those different physical processes sort of act separately in different parts of the domain, rather than acting concurrently. Okay, and so now, what are the technical issues or the approach? We're going to hopefully solve a reduced problem. It's sort of a jigsaw puzzle, right? We're going to chop up the domain, solve a simpler problem out here, solve a simpler problem in here, I mean, compared to the full problem. But then we've got to somehow join the two approximate solutions, and that's asymptotic matching, okay? So that's the idea. And is there anything else I want to say in general? Probably not, okay? And as I did last week, I will start with a very elementary example. If you've done it before, you know, it's definitely, if you haven't done it before, then hopefully it's instructive. But then my plan is to try to get onto a problem that I mentioned last week that may be of interest, which would be the damping of linear, basically shallow water gravity waves, okay, due to bottom boundary layers. And what I like about that example is that actually I end up bringing both of these approaches to bear on the problem, so it's maybe useful in that regard. Okay, so here's our example one, just an ODE. It's a boundary value problem, and this is the boundary value problem, but Baylor said I couldn't just write down that. I had to sort of motivate it. So, okay, fine. Let's consider a 1D steady distribution of some scalar phi, some pollutant, some whatever. It's only going to be a function of x. And it's subjected to uniform advection. So here's our advecting flow with speed u going to the left. And some very weak diffusion. Okay, and there's some nonlinear source of this thing, just to make it exciting. Okay, and so this would be the, well, ODE, because we're looking for a steady 1D type problem, but that's right. So here's the advection. If u is positive, this thing's going to the left, that's why that's negative. Here's going to be weak diffusion once we make this dimensionless. And here's our source, which could be, in this case, a nonlinear function of phi. Okay? So I claim, you know, let's non-dimensionalize and relabel things. So phi is now y. Hope that's the only potentially really confusing thing here. And put everything on one side of the equation. And this problem is basically that one. Okay, so now we have some physical context, if you want.
So this nonlinear function, you just make expansion in Taylor series, yeah? Or, I mean,
well, No, I will not. Sorry, I see what you're saying. No, I just dreamed something up in the first instance. So I just made up a function of phi.
Okay.
That's all I did. But what I thought you were getting at, which is not, is we're not going to do some weakly nonlinear treatment of the source. So asymptotic methods, both of these approaches, can really be applied to nonlinear problems, not just weakly nonlinear problems. And so that's one reason. I mean, I don't know a fully analytical solution to this problem, but for small epsilon, it's very easy to get an asymptotic approximation. So that's kind of cool.
And the right hand side is zero because you're looking for a steady state? Solution?
Yeah, I mean, I rearranged this with d by dt zero.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, well, if epsilon is small, we would do the usual thing. You always start with the quote-unquote naive expansion or regular perturbation expansion, which I seem to have lost. Where's my regular? Did I write out an expansion? No. Substitute expansion. Ah, here it is. Sorry. If I don't box things in, I can't see them. Right, so x depends parametrically on epsilon. Epsilon is small, so we just naively say, well, why don't we try something like this, okay? It's very important in matched asymptotics in particular to be explicitly aware of the limit processes that you are taking. Because usually that's where you get in trouble, is you are implicitly, you know, using a certain limit process, but you're not conscious of that. And then things, you know, you get contradictions and you're wondering what's going on. So it really helps to be explicitly aware of the limit process. So we would say that when we do this, we're fixing x, you know, not equal to zero. We're not right at a boundary. And we're letting epsilon go to zero. Okay, so for each fixed x, you could imagine letting epsilon go to zero. And basically what goes along with that is that the x derivatives, we've non-dimensionalized such that we expect these things to be order one. That's what we're thinking when we take this limit. Okay, so we take this expansion and we stuff it into the differential equation and the boundary conditions. We'll get to that in a minute. And we, you know, collect terms at different orders in epsilon. So at order one, here's our problem. It's fully nonlinear, but it happens to be first order. Right, so we can solve that, no problem, there's the solution. You know, that's the point. The divide and conquer approach often is easier than attacking the full problem with all its complexity at once. Okay. So here's the solution, that's great. But of course we have an immediate problem because we have one free constant of integration, but we have two boundary conditions. Another way of saying that is, you know, this is a first order equation, but the original problem for small but non-zero epsilon exactly is second order. So this is singular. It's a change of type of the or order of the equation. So it's not a shock, but you know, here it is in our face. So going to higher order in the expansion won't help. You're just in trouble fundamentally. And the resolution is, you know, not profound because we all do science, but the idea is that the scaling estimate of y double prime in particular, or gradients of y, which we assumed were order one the way we non-dimensionalized, is poor, at least in some region of x. these dimensionless gradients are much bigger than we thought. So this product, epsilon, even though epsilon's getting very small, y double prime may not, in fact, be negligible everywhere in the domain. All right, so that's the key idea, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Okay, so the first question then is, okay, maybe this is a boundary layer problem, and, you know, so where is the boundary layer? Okay, and in my experience, there are two ways to answer this. One is to reason physically. Usually that's good enough. Certainly in the example we're going to do next, which is the shallow water, you know, we have a no-slip condition down at the, you know, the benthic boundary, and we're going to assume, you know, there will be a boundary layer down there, okay? So in this problem, if I just came and didn't say any of that and wrote that down, you know, you might not know immediately where it is if you haven't done this before. I like to, especially when the equations are of this form, always interpret them as advection diffusion equations. Okay? So if we come back over here, remember phi is y, which way is the advection? To the left, right? The advection is strong, you know, the diffusion is supposedly weak. But you could imagine you could get in trouble, because you could specify a boundary condition here and advect it along, no worries. Like method of characteristics, basically. You know, but then you get here, and the value of the pollutant or whatever concentration doesn't agree with this independently specified boundary condition that you need to enforce at y equals zero. So there's a mismatch.
Sorry, but advection is non-uniform?
No, here I'm just saying it's uniform. This is not that physical. Again, Baylor made me. I do think thinking about these, you know, second order equations as advection diffusion problems, if you're a fluids person, is an easy way to get, then you absolutely know where the boundary layer is. So alternatively, you can do trial and error, and for question two when we get to, oh, there it is. Trial and error is important in asymptotics. And I don't mean that as you just try anything. I mean, you have to systematically go through different possibilities. And the possibilities, you know, grow exponentially often. So you really do want to use, you know, any intuition you have, any physical intuition, et cetera, to limit the choices. You're usually looking out for whether you can match solutions. Remember, it's a jigsaw puzzle, or contradictions, things like that.
So, Greg, yes? This is all fine when you're thinking about boundary conditions that are... I mean, so you can check one boundary, you can check the other boundary, because you have some sense that it's probably near the boundary where the double derivative is going to come in and do something interesting. But in some problems, you end up with an interior...
Sure, an internal layer.
Or something, yep. That, where you jump.
Yep.
So is there...
Same logic. I mean, same logic.
The same logic.
Same logic. This guy,
yeah.
If it were u of x, and the flow did something like... That, well, it probably have to be none, you know, right? The point is you could bring information in, no problem from either side, but there might be a mismatch in the middle. So the logic is the same. I think the physical intuition, you know, can help, but, you know, of course, you can try systematically the endpoints. You know, that sort of seems easy, right? But you can also try systematically the interior by saying x is some x naught or star or something, which is any point in the interior, plus whatever your boundary layer. You know, you're just shifting your coordinate where the boundary layer is. So then there are three cases to try, basically. Okay. So let's not confuse everybody.
There's a singular parabolic problem, Greg.
Yeah?
Yeah. A nice example is oil spreading on water.
Oh, yeah.
So you have
that's a good one for this group.
And it's spreading out. And so here at the leading edge, of course, you've got essentially Blasius, and the boundary layer thickness, which you're going to define later, goes to zero. But right at the source, you can have two cases where the boundary layer thickness again goes to zero. And you have what's called a Sakyatis boundary. But yeah, the bottom line is that the equations are parabolic exactly as you've written there, but you get a two-way convection.
Yeah.
They're quite nasty, but okay. They're interesting.
Yeah.
So in that case, can you identify the transition of type or something?
Yes.
That gives you a hint as to where to look?
Yeah, you can actually classify them. I actually did that. But it's the same problem of with shockwaves sort of situation there, because you can have a shockwave sort of in between the two boundary layers, and you get this jump.
Right, so what are we going to do? We are going to agree that in this problem, the boundary layer is at x equals 0. So here's quiz question one. So on this solution, which doesn't know anything about the diffusive term, where are we going to impose a boundary condition, one, to determine C1? I mean, that was a choice, like, do we figure out C1 by imposing this or this? So what's the choice? Yeah, okay. So we do that, so we say, so technically, I mean, again, just being pedantic, the at x equals 1, we would expand the boundary condition, and so we'd say y naught of 1 plus epsilon, y1 of 1 plus blah, 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 equals 1 half. And don't forget, that's really 1 half plus 0 times epsilon plus 0 times epsilon, so you match order by order. So it's only this first one that would be inhomogeneous, right? So we get that y naught of 1 better equal 1 half, from which we figure out the constant is 1, and then y naught of x is 1 over x plus 1. And that's a solution over most of the domain, but not very close to, clearly, when x is 0, this doesn't satisfy y is 0. Okay, so we have the boundary. So the next question is how to scale the boundary layer. Okay, how thick is it? And typically what we do is we zoom in, we rescale our x coordinate, so we can focus on what's going on very close to the to that region. So x is some, you know, this is the thing I'd like to figure out, the thickness of the boundary layer as a function of my small parameter epsilon. That's what I mean here. Okay, so delta is small. Delta is going to 0 as epsilon goes to 0, but I would like to know how, at what rate. C will be my new, you know, rescaled x coordinate. Okay, so my limit process now will be C is fixed, okay, with epsilon going to 0. So if C is fixed, by the way, that means x over delta is fixed, right? And remember, as epsilon goes to 0, delta is going to 0. So what's x doing? Going to 0, right? So you're staying, no matter how small you make epsilon. So my picture over here was for one particular value of epsilon. Here's a bigger value of epsilon. Here's a smaller value of epsilon, right? No matter how small I make epsilon, I am adjust, you know, I'm going staying in the boundary layer. I don't want to get left behind in what's called the outer region. So, okay, that's easy enough. Then, as with everything in asymptotics, you need a chain rule. So, we'll say y, the original y, the y in what we call the outer region. In the inner region, I'm going to call it y tilde, just so we know our boundary layer variables. And it's a function of xi rather than x, and still parametrically dependent on epsilon. You do the chain rule, so dy dx becomes 1 over delta, remember delta is small, times dy tilde dxi. Right? So this is the thing that I'm hoping I've scaled in such a way to be order one, the dimensionless, you know, rescaled derivative, y dy tilde dxi order one. But that would tell me, but if delta is small, then dy dx, you know, in terms of my outer scale, would be very big, which is what we were saying would happen near the origin. Okay, so that's that. And now we just rewrite our differential equation, but now I need to erase. So we rewrite the differential equation, our ODE, it becomes epsilon on delta squared d squared y tilde dx plus 1 over delta dy tilde dx and then plus y tilde squared. Okay. So all I did, no approximations, I just re-non-dimensionalized, if you like. That's all I've done. But now I have to you know, figure out how to relate delta and epsilon, basically. And before I do that, I should make the comment that in nonlinear problems, you sometimes would need to rescale the dependent variable also. Okay, so it's all well and good to figure, you know, say you're going to rescale the boundary layer coordinate, right, the independent variable. But often in nonlinear problems, PDEs, you know, you end up having to rescale the dependent variables also. And, you know, again, the number of possibilities is what actually is challenging sometimes. In this problem, it's nonlinear, yes, but we kind of already know what's going on, don't we? You know, away from the origin, this guy's sort of order 1, and even as x goes to 0, this is still order 1. Sorry, I should point here. You know, as x goes to 0, this is 1, in fact. So although at the origin, the function is 0, right, within the boundary layer, it's jumping up to an order 1 value. So in this problem, it's pretty clear that even in the boundary layer, at leading order, y tilde is order 1. That is to say, the expansion for y tilde will start at y tilde naught. Okay? So with that understood, then I can hope that, you know, insist that these dimensionless derivatives or dimensionless terms are order 1, and I'm really just comparing, you know, the coefficients. Okay? And, you know, the lingo is that you look for a dominant balance at leading order that is sensible. What does sensible mean? Well, it's you're looking out for matchability and contradictions, things like that. But I can at least give some rules of thumb. One rule of thumb is we're going to insist that the term that we dropped that caused the problems is a player at leading order. Right? I mean, that sort of seems reasonable. Right? So we're going to insist that our diffusion term that we had dropped is of leading order. So it's not always diffusion, you know, it's sort of this effect that you dropped is of leading order. A rule of thumb is that often you need basically at least one common term in the leading order PDE for the outer problem and the inner problem. So what's the leading order PDE for the outer problem? The leading order PDE is this, right? What I'm saying, and when we just said number one, is that we pick up a new term, the term we draw, right? But we need something in common because they have to know about each other. Otherwise, this matchability is unlikely to be achievable. Now, this is a rule of thumb, and there are, you can always concoct problems that are more complicated or subtle or whatever. But rule of thumb, you want one term at least in common between the leading order outer and BL problems. Okay, so let's run through some possibilities real quick. Again, and I'm not going to write it, but this idea of looking out for matchability and contradictions. You know, one possibility is that the first and third terms balance, okay? But that one you can rule out right away because then what is epsilon over delta squared? It's 1. It's got to be so that these terms are the same size. But then those terms are order 1, but the middle term is big because delta is small. So, I mean, that's a contradiction before you even get going. I mean, maybe a possibility, in contrast to what I've just said in number 2, is that this term dominates on its own, okay? But we can solve that leading order problem in our head, right? Then y is a linear function of xi. And then, I mean, I'll talk about matching in a second, but basically the boundary layer coordinate xi is semi-infinite. I'll explain that in a second. But the point is, if the dominant equation term is just this one, then you would have d squared y tilde, you know, not the leading order one, dx squared equals 0, or approximately 0, you get a linear function, and then you're in trouble because this thing will blow up as c goes to infinity, meaning that y naught is way bigger than order 1 when it gets to the outer region. So that's no good either. So the only possibility is that you balance those two in this problem. When you do that, we can now figure out what delta must be. It must be epsilon, okay? So for this problem, it's not always the case. Delta is epsilon, okay? And if that's true, then my rescaling was x equals epsilon xi. Okay. So hopefully that's all good. And now we're almost done with this toy example here. Now having made that choice, we can clean this up, right? So this is 1 over epsilon, this is 1 over epsilon. So let me multiply through by epsilon. Right. There it is. So that's exact. No approximations. Now that we've done the rescaling, we can pose this regular perturbation expansion again, as we argued that y tilde does indeed start at order 1. Okay? So we're going to posit that, I'm now completely out of chalk. We're going to posit that y tilde of x, not x, c, and epsilon is y tilde naught of c plus epsilon y tilde 1, etc. Okay? Take that, we stuff it into the equation, we collect it, we do just what we did, right? You just repeat those steps. And at order 1, what we find, of course, is that d squared y tilde naught dc plus dy naught dc equals 0. Okay? If you think about the physics for a minute, it does make sense that, like, you know, the gradients are big there. Actually, you know, for y being order 1, this term is weak. The source doesn't affect things much. Okay, so we solve this problem, of course, and we get that y naught of c is b naught plus b1 e to the negative c. There you go. And now the question is, how do we figure out b naught and b1? And you say, well, I had a second order equation, I got two constants. So for sure we're going to impose the boundary condition at x equals 0. X equals 0 is c equals 0. Okay? Question is, what are we going to, you know, we need another condition, right? And what you will not do is impose the boundary condition at x equals 1, right? Because that's in a region in which this approximation is not good. Instead, what you're going to do is put the jigsaw pieces together and do asymptotic matching, link up the outer and the so-called inner boundary layer approximation. And that's how we'll determine these two constants. Right? So the boundary condition at x equals c equals 0 is that y naught of 0, or sorry, y naught tilde, I've lost my tilde here, is, 0 or 1? 0, right? And so that gives us that y naught tilde of c is, b naught times 1 minus e to the negative c. And we can convince ourselves that if c is 0, 1 minus 1 is 0. Yeah, it works. Okay? So now we have to figure out this other constant via matching. So that's our third question, which is how to determine this constant. The answer is matching, but what the heck does that mean? How do you do it? Oh, I erased. No, I didn't. That's what we need. Okay. So question 3 was how to determine some of these unknown constants and PDEs. These might be functions of integration, right? And the answer is asymptotic matching. The notion of matching relies on the hope, right, that these two apparently disjoint approximations, the outer and the inner, or boundary layer, actually have some, you know, small regime of validity, in which, region of validity in which they're both valid. And that's what allows the matching to happen. And I'll say at the outset, asymptotic matching, right, is different than patching. Patching is a numerical procedure when you say, you know, at x equals 0.01, I'm going to determine b naught by pinning, you know, this guy to the outer. That's lovely, and sometimes that's all you can do, but, you know, your function is probably not going to be differentiable, even if it's continuous when you do that, right? So matching is much better because you'll end up with smooth differentiable functions. Okay, so this is, the idea is, basically, we would like the outer limit of the inner approximation to equal the inner limit of the outer approximation. So in this process, so I'm just asserting that, in this process, what would the outer limit of the inner approximation, okay, so here's our inner approximation. I'd like to take the outer limit. What was the outer limit process? X fixed, not zero, epsilon goes to zero. So if I want to take the outer limit of this, it's first, as a preparatory step, appropriate to rewrite C in terms of X, because I want to take the outer limit, okay? So I'm rewriting this guy, y naught tilde, as b naught times 1 minus e to the negative x on epsilon, because c is x over epsilon. And again, I'm doing this because I want to take an outer limit, right? For the outer limit, I fix x, not, I guess, not too small, and I let epsilon go to 0. Right? And when I do that, of course, this will go away. So if I take the outer limit of this limit, you know, x fixed, not 0, epsilon goes to 0, sorry, limit of all of that, I get b naught in this case. Right? Now I want to take the inner limit of the outer approximation. So my outer approximation was over there. So I'm going to rewrite the outer approximation as y naught is 1 over, I'll move the 1 over, 1 plus x, which is epsilon c, okay? And now I'm going to fix c and let epsilon go to 0, which the reality check, yeah, x is going to 0, that's what we want, right? And the inner limit, let's write that, limit c fixed, not infinity, as epsilon goes to 0 of this thing is going to be 1, but you know, you could Taylor series expand, etc. And so then we have to say that these are equal, so b naught equals 1, okay? Now, there are many questions here that would take us way too far afield, okay? You know, why does this work? I mean, can we justify it more rigorously? That would be one thing. Another question is, like when you go to higher order, let's say you keep two terms in the outer and two terms in the inner, can you just match them the same way? You know, what can you do? There's a somewhat general and usually successful approach that's called intermediate variable matching. Intermediate variable. So we've already talked about two limits, right? The outer limit, x fixed, epsilon goes to 0. The inner limit, xi fixed, epsilon goes to 0, right? You could define a limit process that's sort of between these two. And in some sense, that's what you want. Because simultaneously, to do this matching, you want x headed to 0, right, for the outer. And you want, at the same time, you know, xi headed to infinity because you want to get out of the boundary layer for the inner approximation. So I will briefly touch upon that in the more complicated example, okay? But I'm just going to drop the term for now, the intermediate. So the final point is, we've got these two approximate solutions, but they seem to hold in different parts of the domain. Can we make a uniform approximation? And we can. So I guess we have one last question here, which is how to construct a uniformly valid approximation. Uniformly asymptotic, uniformly valid approximation. And that, there are different ways to do this, but one approach is called making an additive composite. So the uniformly valid approximation, sometimes called the composite approximation, it's going to use both inner and outer information. And the recipe is just as follows. So y composite, yc, is y outer plus y inner boundary layer, which I guess I put a tilde on, minus y overlap, what they have in common, because you don't want to count that part twice. And that was exactly this to the order we work things out. So for our particular problem, we would take y outer, which was 1 over x plus 1. We take y boundary layer, which was this thing with b naught equal to 1. Okay, so plus 1 minus e to the negative x on epsilon, and we would subtract y overlap, which was b naught or 1, because they're the same thing. So the 1's go away, and this is 1 over x plus 1 minus e to the negative x over epsilon. And that's our, well, let's do this. That's our composite approximation, which should be valid over the whole domain, and it is differentiable, right? It's not like just patching. Okay, so that was at high speed, your crash course in matched asymptotics. I'll stop and take a breath before, talking about an ocean, well, at least a wave problem. So questions? I'm probably not telling anyone they don't already know.
Okay, I would like to make a small comment here. In principle, one additional simplifications can be done, especially if you don't consider only quadratic nonlinearity, if you exclude by transformation the first derivatives, mm-hmm. and then reduce the equation to the like a Schrodinger type mm-hmm. equation, and using experience from the quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
This very often helps to perform similar analysis with matching asymptotics.
So usually, once you get something in Schrodinger form, you end up doing like a WKB mm-hmm. approximation, which in my world I would categorize as a variant of the method of generalization of the method of multiple scales.
Mm-hmm.
But often you still have to do an asymptotic matching problem, the connection problem, where you get area functions or something, and that's really this.
Mm-hmm.
I think an interesting sort of, if you're into asymptotics question is, is there really some super method that is above both of these methods that embraces them both? And so there are some problems that look like asymptotic, matching problems, boundary layer problems, to which you could apply the method of multiple scales and actually solve them. But it's usually not easier than doing. Okay, so other questions? So if not, go ahead, please.
If we were to plot this solution
versus
the exact, exact solution,
yeah.
Would you expect that it's pretty good for epsilon?
1.1.
Do you have like a feel, an intuition for? I mean, typically these things work better
than expected.
Than you would expect.
This one won't, because if you go to next order, there are like logarithms,
uh-huh.
and in the those usually mean that epsilon needs to be smaller than you'd like.
Okay.
But you're right, there are many problems. WKB problems always seem to work for, epsilon's not that small. Epsilon is 1 or something. But I have the only applications of asymptotics where I think it's not, somewhat elementary to think about those kinds of like bounds on epsilon, or when you're doing asymptotic evaluation of integrals or approximation of integrals, so you have some transform solution and you're interested in a large time behavior or whatever large space. It's, in those cases, because you have an integral representation, of the truth, sometimes you can do some rigorous mathematics to bound, that's not so hard, so that you could bound, that basically the asymptotic error and then have some numerical estimates for how small epsilon needs to be to get, something reasonable. But for differential equations in these methods, I don't have any. I'll ask some members of the audience is there a simple answer to how small epsilon has to be?
No, it's always trial and error.
Yeah. Well, that's why, except you need the truth. So you need to be able to compare to a DNS or to laboratory experiments or things like that if you want to make that even that assessment.
So, Greg, I had another question about this additive composite piece. So why can't I just replace, why can't I multiply the two solutions together instead and have 1 minus e to the minus x over epsilon times 1 over x plus 1. That second term is going.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's another one which.
Yep.
There. Sometimes you, because it's sort of like b naught is coming to 1, so mm-hmm. I could just, but so is 1 over x plus 1, so I could just replace b naught mm-hmm. with 1 over x plus 1 mm-hmm. rather than
so,
additive and subtraction.
So there is such a thing as a multiplicative composite.
Yeah.
Yeah. and I'm not going to write down the rule, but yes. Yeah, and so they might, you know, the result might differ than the one I've written in. But hopefully, you know, but yeah, if we're going to trust it, then hopefully that discrepancy, I mean, ideally it's like exponentially small or something, but it's at least at higher order than the order to which you have computed this approximation.
The Taylor figure that e to the minus x over epsilon, it would be clear why they're the same.
Yeah.
It's still a funny business that you've got two answers that look functionally different, but are all, you know, formally the same.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes certain functional forms are better than others for various reasons. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Oh, more questions. Oh, this is good. Now
can you talk about what happens to the symmetries and conservation laws of the underlying PDE when you start to get these?
No. This is a very good question, and I know why you're asking, and probably
hang out with Rick Salmon a lot.
Well, and I mean, Bill works as well. Well, Bill, sorry, works with methods that preserve certain conservation laws.
Yeah, I tend to take.
I don't have a simple answer for that. My firm belief in my experience is if you do this carefully, you preserve all of those rules to the order, you know, of accuracy that you've worked things out. And so Jeff Vallis, for example, has a nice illustration of that point in his, you know, textbook that he came out with some years ago. And, you know, sometimes variational approaches from which you start, it's difficult to incorporate dissipation in a natural way. And I'm very much always interested in forced dissipative problems, even if the dissipation is weak, but not zero. So it's for me, in my humble opinion, I trust F equals MA and conservation of mass, and I just try to work systematically from there. But I would confess that sometimes you will, it's inelegant. You might do a lot of work. I'm about to do it right now to get a result that might more easily be arrived at, for example, if you start with a variational formulation.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about you introduce additional symmetries sometimes into the problem when you take asymptotic approximation. So it's interesting in thinking about solution space and even number of conservation
laws. Yeah.
You know, if you start with the water wave equations, make some approximations, you get KdV, which is integrable.
Yeah.
So you went from having like 10 conservation laws to an infinite number.
Right.
And it's interesting to think about how that actually constrains the evolution of your
approximate
and how that corresponds to the actual solution to the full equations.
Right.
Yeah, the same is true of QG versus.
I was going to say, isn't when I'm thinking of Keith's,
so QG work, has an infinite number of potential vorticity rather than just a few.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer, and it's a fair and good point.
Kind of a jerk question.
No. That's why we're here. right, okay, so I'll see what I can do with a more physically interesting example. I probably will only be able to hit some highlights, but okay. So so I am thinking about a shallow layer of, you know, Newtonian viscous fluid with a free surface. And the layer is shallow in the sense that if I'm thinking about waves with gravity being the restoring force, the wavelength proportional to, you know, wave number inverse is large compared to the depth of the layer. Okay, so shallow water waves. I'm not worrying about Coriolis effects. You could put them in, etc. But I am going to be, and I should say that I'm worried, thinking about waves, so they're going to be weak, basically linear. But the point of this example is to discuss the role of bottom friction, and I don't mean turbulence or anything like that. I just mean laminar oscillatory, because we have a wave motion, bottom, you know, viscous boundary layer. Okay, so that's the name of the game. And the physical questions would be, surely that's, you know, a key, plays an important role in the damping of this wave, right? And so can we work out explicitly, albeit approximately, you know, the damping coefficient, and not just the time scale, but the coefficient for damping of the wave. And there's some interesting physics, because basically some simple order of magnitude estimates would say that at large Reynolds number, right, the damping that happens in some thin boundary layer down here, okay, or the dissipation, I should say, the energy dissipation, dominates the energy dissipation in the bulk. That's very easy to estimate. I won't do it, but we can do it at the end if you want to, okay? So the dissipation down here dominates the energy dissipation of the wave in the interior, assuming the Reynolds number is large, which it is. Now, of course, there's actually a free surface boundary layer as well, but that's the dissipation there is weaker because it's a free surface, so we're not even going to talk about that, okay? So what I think a little bit interesting, somewhat akin to Ekman pumping kinds of ideas, is that there's sort of an inner-outer interaction, right? Basically, the wave is inviscid out here, certainly at leading order, but there's friction down here, so how does that information, that friction, you know, get communicated back to the interior to somehow slowly cause the wave amplitude to decay, like our weakly damped mass spring system? You know, how does that all play out, right, that physics? And and I will mention at the very end, even though it's, you know, lots of pages of algebra, I'll just write down the key results. Actually, because the other interesting bit of physics is there's vorticity down here. Vorticity, whereas the wave is basically irrotational. And when you have fluctuating vorticity, you have a chance that the Reynolds stress divergence from that fluctuating vorticity could drive a mean flow. So that's another reason this boundary layer, though often ignored, would be interesting. So I just wanted to sort of give you the roadmap before I get bogged down.
I mean, both of those effects have interesting analogs in the more complicated surface boundary or bottom boundary layer questions. They're the overall scope of this. The turbulent dissipation does tend to be dominated. When you measure the levels of turbulent dissipation, it is typically a boundary layer thing, not an interior thing, and for similar kinds of reasons.
Well,
so that's, you know...
I was interested in what you said yesterday. If I understood you correctly, that the interior, you said at the very end of your presentation, that the dissipation, the energy dissipation, was controlled by your surface mixed layer, you know, dissipation, which was just, and that was just parameterization. In your case,
those two, so we have bottom,
and,
so
yeah. But that dominated it.
All of the energy is going out of the boundary layers.
So
very, very little is being dissipated in
the interior.
The horizontal process, and in that case, it was the parameterization of a forward cascade.
Right.
But that
it still didn't.
Is very weak
compared
for all the
to
reasons that Jim was talking about Monday.
Yeah.
Because that class of turbulence likes to send its energy upscale, so the boundary layer is the only place that can.
That's really doing it. So why we're
I think that's really ugly and complicated when they're vertical shear and things, which we can talk about later.
Okay. So again, I have to just sort of hit highlights. I'm, you know, Brad gave you a quiz. I'm going to give somebody homework soon. But, what am I doing? My horizontal length scale is going to be K inverse. My vertical scale in the first instance will be the layer depth. My time scale will be the period or inverse frequency of the wave. I have some 2B set velocity scale, and this is indicative, I mean, this is a horizontal velocity associated with this wave motion. Okay, that's what that capital U is. For reasons of incompressibility, the vertical velocity associated with this long wavelength wave will be weaker by a factor of the aspect ratio, KH. Okay, that's from incompressibility. And in the first instance, I'll scale the pressure hydrostatically. So we do that, and then we just write down the dimensionless equations. So I need to write these equations somewhere, or maybe I can leave them. So I'm sorry. Hopefully this is legible. Okay. Oops. Oh, and I didn't plan very well. Sorry. Okay, I'll define parameters in a minute. I don't know how legible that is from where you're sitting. But Navier, 2D, so Navier-Stokes in the X and in the Z direction and compressibility, that's all we have going on there. The nonlinear terms are pre-multiplied by, I'll define parameters in a minute, epsilon, some funny coefficients of pressure involving epsilon and a Froude number, Froude squared. This delta is going to be my aspect ratio. So the horizontal diffusion is weak compared to the vertical diffusion because we're long and thin, even in the outer domain. And the kinematic condition at the free surface, given my scaling, is W is 1 on epsilon dHdt plus udHdx. We should have normal stress continuity. If nu is not 0, we should also have tangential stress continuity. And down at the bottom, we have no normal flow and also no slip. U equals 0 if nu is not 0. Okay, so let me talk about the parameters for a minute. Okay, so I have epsilon is uk on omega. My Froude number is u over the square root of gh. The aspect ratio delta is kh. And I have a wave Reynolds number, REW, which is omega on k squared nu. Oh, sorry, yeah. So everything is dimensionless over there. This was dimensional. So big H nominally is 1, right, if the free surface is not deformed. And we're going to enforce that in a second, actually. Yes?
Don't you have viscosity
on the... Oh, yeah.
Well.
Thank you. Oh, what have I done?
Just put a bracket.
Oh, thank you. But I'm worried about something else. But, yeah, okay. Well, no, REW, good. Yeah. Bracket, same as that one. Not that one, but that one. Okay, thank you. And W, not acting on W. Good? Okay. So, why have I made my Z's capital and my W's capital? That's just for me to remind myself that I've scaled differently in X than in Z. And this is still for the outer. I'm not talking about a boundary layer yet. Okay? So here's really this lecture was supposed to be about Nash asymptotics, and I promise we'll get to it in a minute. But, you know, in some sense, really what this became for me, you know, this is really how asymptotics goes. You have, the real challenge is linking small parameters or large parameters in some sensible way. So, I mean, we have this mass, 4 dimensionless parameters, 3 of which we think should be small and 1 of which is large. And the question is how big and how small in relation to each other, okay? So the process of linking small or large parameters is called taking a distinguished limit, you know, through parameter space where, say, as epsilon goes to 0, Froude is, I don't know, square root epsilon, I'm making something up now, right, and delta is something else in terms of epsilon. So a particular choice will yield, you know, a particular reduced system with its predictions. But if you make a different choice, you may end up very well with a different reduced system. So that may be unnerving or disturbing. But, you know, you make the choices. I think the criteria are, A, you want to end up with something mathematically sensible and self-consistent and closed, you know, a closed reduced system. And then, of course, B, you'd like that your estimates of your parameters, if you're plugging in some numbers for wave steepness or something, you know, are somehow reasonable. That, you know, something that's astronomically large compared, you know, is appropriately related to the small parameters and some. So you do think physically about it as well.
I think this is also the point that's valuable for numerical work, is if you're trying to make a regime diagram.
Ah, yes.
You do this step, and then you chop up your parameter space and say, here's where one distinguished limit's going to work, here's another,
yeah.
Here's another, and then you just do simulations in each of those and
yeah.
Suspect that they probably are qualitatively similar within that whole regime.
That's right.
And you can, so you go from, you know, 3 to the 4th down to 4
yeah.
Kind of things. So it greatly reduces your work.
Okay.
One small question. In the second equation for W,
yeah.
Nearby the pressure term,
yep.
You have plus
1.
Yes. Yeah, term for what?
That's from gravity, but there's a negative out front.
Oh,
So minus dp/dz minus gravity, pointing down.
Yeah.
I got nervous a minute ago that I forgot gravity, and that was going to be a problem for this phase problem. Yes, please.
See, putting shallow water,
yeah.
Why do you need epsilon in the fruit number? There's the same.
Well, okay, so I knew, no, this is going to be the homework problem, honestly.
It's just for a kid.
Well, what I'm going to insist is that epsilon is small, which is not the usual shallow water linear weight. So the shallow water approximation is delta is small, right? Delta is the aspect ratio. So this being small, wavelength long compared to that, I mean, that's shallow water. If people make court of KdV type equations and things, usually they take the amplitude of the wave amplitude, this has to do with the free surface displacement, call it A or something, to be small compared to the water depth. A over H is small, okay? And I'm going to even be more severe, although I'm not sure in retrospect if it's necessary, and I'm going to say that epsilon is small, my epsilon, okay? So, but...
implies that fruit is small.
Yeah, fruit...
Right now, your definition is identical.
They're identical.
Fruit equals fruit number.
Right.
Oh, yeah, because it's a G.
You have a shallower dispersion relation, exactly, which you don't know yet. But once you go shallow water, then it will come out that that's the dispersion relation, then the epsilon becomes equal to fruit.
Yeah. That's my whole point. We know we're in shallower ways.
Yeah, but you don't know what omega is until you solve for it, and you haven't yet. Right. I mean, you could still, with that equation, say...
That's exactly right. I'm sorry. And in fact, in a few minutes, I'm going to do what you said and convince myself that, again, the name of the game is kind of relating these parameters in some sensible way. And I'm going to argue that fruit, I got nervous here, but that's fruit squared. Fruit is of order epsilon. In fact, they're going to be identical if you, you know, because of the dispersion relation, like with
cold. Yes.
Which is sensible because why would you want more complexity? Igor said something in his presentation that he kept emphasizing he came at this problem of stratified turbulence from the theoretical physics community, and he wasn't biased by, you know, I don't know, Onenkovskoy theory and other things. So I completely was ignorant of mostly ignorant of the shallow water wave literature. And I just did this on my own because I thought, oh, this would be a good pedagogical example that might be of interest. And then it turned out to be a little more involved than I thought. So, all right. So, but thank you. You're exactly right, Lena. So the first thing that we would say is, hey, we're shallow water. If anything, I'm going to, you know, insist that this guy is very small, and you know, somehow, even though this might be one on epsilon, you know, I really expect hydrostatics, you know, to be the dominant balance in the vertical. So if I mean, I hesitate to even write this, but let's just say we did. P is P naught plus, and who knows what the next term is. I've written delta P1, but we're going to see that that's not what we're doing. Okay. But if you do this, then in the Z momentum equation at leading order, making some assumptions about how these parameters are related, okay? You get this, which is just hydrostatics, of course. Okay, so you impose a boundary condition that... P naught at Z equals H, where H is a function of X and T, is P atmospheric. That's my passive atmosphere, just constant pressure. Right, and you chunk that in there, and you get that P naught of X comma Z comma T is P atmospheric. Of course, this is just hydrostatics, is all I'm doing. Plus H of X and T minus Z. Okay, so you get that. Now, from the kinematic boundary condition, someone had already pointed this out because Brad, I think, was asking me about H. Remember, nominally, if the free surface is not deformed, H is 1. Okay? If epsilon is small, okay, and I'm going to insist that it is small, then I'm going to have a problem if H, when the free surface is deformed, is order 1. Right, because this term would dominate. Is that clear? So if I insist that epsilon is small, okay, then if H is order one, you know, this time derivative, you know, this whole term will dominate the other things. And that's not going to work for a wave problem because I need W to be able to be the same size, right? So that's going to cause me to just immediately redefine H. Right, so basically redefine H so that it's 1 plus epsilon eta, and separately I can expand eta. Is that all right? Of course, I don't really know the form of the expansion yet, which is part of the challenge, but okay. So I'm going to insist that my displacements are not too big because I'm going to be doing linear wave theory here. So when you put that in here, right, and you then think about dh, dt, well, let's just first say that this, of course, means that db dt of h is epsilon db dt of eta, and db dx of h is epsilon db dx of eta. I like epsilon times, you know, because that makes this guy 1, okay? It makes the nonlinear term small, so I like that. But now I'm also thinking back to the x-momentum equation. I'm really trying to get my leading order sort of approximation to this guy, dp dx. Okay, so I'm looking ahead. So for the x-momentum equation, this was the z-momentum equation at leading order, what's my expectation? What is my expectation? It's that this pressure gradient, horizontal, is balanced by local inertia, local acceleration of the fluid. I'm expecting those terms to be the same size for a wave, okay? So that's why I'm obsessed with the pressure, because I want to figure out, right? So the point is that I have a term like negative epsilon on Froude squared times dp dx, and that is asymptotic to negative epsilon on Froude squared times dB dx of P naught. Okay, now dB dx of P naught, that's a constant. That doesn't depend on x. dH dx, but we said dH dx was, you know, epsilon eta. And if I expand eta, it's epsilon d eta dx naught, right? So this thing is basically equal to negative epsilon squared on Froude squared dB dx of eta naught, if you like. Okay, so did I do any? So this was epsilon on Froude squared, but dP dx gave me a dH dx, dH dx gave me another epsilon. Okay, so epsilon squared. Okay, so I want this term, you know, to be of similar size as du dt. And I think I've non-dimensionalized this correctly, right? Because time was non-dimensionalized with wave frequency. And u, I said, was scaled by the wave, you know, horizontal velocity. So this is indeed order one when it's dimensionless. So that's if I want this to be, you know, this is dimensionless to be order one, then I'm going to insist that Froude is of order epsilon. And in fact, from the dispersion, so you can go through and make it, put in a free, so I'm going to choose Froude equals some constant times epsilon. I think I called it a naught or something silly. But I've you know, worked this out backwards so that I know that a naught is 1. Okay, so this ends up being 1 given the dispersion relation that we're going to find for sure. Okay, so this is your point. Froude is epsilon. Okay. So Froude is epsilon. So okay, at least we don't have so many small parameters. Now, the final comment before we move on to the getting the outer solution is that dp dx is you know, negative d eta dx. Eta is the free surface displacement. It is not a function of z, right? So the driving of this wave is z independent, right? The x pressure gradient is independent of z. So it's reasonable to look for a solution for the acceleration, the du dt term, that is also independent of z. Of course, this will lead to our difficulty, right? Because how is that going to satisfy no slip, u equals 0? So that's the idea.
Small question, just with Elise. Could you please repeat boundary conditions at z equal h?
Yeah.
This is w equal?
Yeah, sorry. 1 over epsilon dh dt plus u dh dx. So that's because we have a flapping free surface.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just no normal flow. Okay.
Okay,
that's all that is. Right. Okay, so not only did we do this, but we now have argued that seek a solution with u naught, when we expand u, where it's just a function of x and t, not of z. So we're going to seek a solution of that form. Okay? Okay, now we can actually start writing some things in a sensible way, almost. Oh, almost. I need you all to feel my pain. Here's the problem. Right? If you're doing asymptotics, you'd like to at least know what the truth is, right? What your equation, your starting equations are exactly before you start rescaling and substituting expansions, etc. But even to get this kind of problem started, you know, I'm needing to make approximations to realize that this motivate, how do I link epsilon and fruit? How do I, you know, why am I looking for u naught that depends only on x, etc. So all I'm trying to do right now is get basically the equations, which are written exactly over there. I want a new version that is, you know, approximate, but out to some power of epsilon that's good enough for everything I'm going to do subsequently. And the trick is just this pressure term, okay? So what I'm about to write is motivated by that desire. So the pressure, expansion of the pressure field is the following. So it's that P of X, Z, and T. And now I'm going to think of all parameters being linked to epsilon rather than to delta. They're all going to be tied together. Is P atmospheric minus Z, that was your hydrostatic bit, plus 1, plus epsilon eta naught. Okay, this was the H, at least part of H, right? And then, you know, of course there could be, you would think there could be epsilon squared eta 1 or something. But remember, eta depends only on X and T, not on Z. The pressure can start depending on Z. So I'm going to allow that to happen by calling something pi, perturbation pressure, right, which depends on X, Z, and T. But, you know, to what power? So it's epsilon squared, epsilon what, right? I'm going to put a delta there. That is to be determined boundary layer thickness. Now, first of all, okay, you know, why am I talking about boundary layers now? Remember, there's going to be communication between the Stokes layer, sorry, the oscillatory boundary layer and the interior. And you have to try things sometimes. Sometimes you don't even know the form of the expansion until you play around a little. So I'm sorry, but, you know, I can, you know, keep you in suspense to figure out how delta is related to epsilon, but I have to make this workable, say that that's the right choice. And then I can expand pi as pi naught plus, you know, whatever powers, okay? So this just lets me rewrite those equations, which I probably don't want to rewrite. If you allow me, I'll just rewrite the pressure term out to the order that I need it. So this is d by dx of eta naught, and then plus delta times d by dx of pi, where I can expand pi. And then for the next line, sorry, this one, for the when I plug in here, and I remember epsilon on fruit squared is 1 on epsilon, so... this ends up being, oops, not epsilon, delta, d pi dz.
Right, because now you have only the non-hydrostatic pressure.
Yep, exactly. Okay. One last bit of maneuvering. We take our We take our kinematic condition, having substituted H is 1 plus epsilon eta. This is still exact, because I can expand eta afterwards. And you can integrate this right over the domain to get a global statement of mass conservation. And I'm skipping the details, but what you can find exactly is that dA to dt plus the flux, d by dx of the integral from z equals 0 to z equals 1 plus epsilon eta of u dz is zero. So that's just global mass conservation. And that will be useful for what we're doing. Okay.
So it's like a variant of continuity equation or what?
Yeah, it's just, exactly. It's just integrating continuity across the domain using boundary conditions. Okay. So I think we are almost in good shape here. Okay, so for small amplitude waves, we're thinking epsilon is indeed small. So we might expand our various fields. I'll just write one of them here. And we would take that expansion, we'd stuff it into the governing equations, and we collect terms at different orders, okay? So, let's see. Maybe I'll write down just these guys. So du naught dx equals negative dx eta naught. D by dt of eta naught plus d by dx u naught equals 0. That's a closed subsystem. And as an aside, we have that d by dx of u naught plus d by dz of w naught equals 0, and that d by dz of pi naught equals negative d by dt of w naught. So in shallow water systems, this is always how it goes, right? You have your horizontal velocity from the momentum equation. You actually, from continuity, could recover W if you wanted to, right? And then having recovered W, you could get the pressure field that was associated. Okay, so that's how it goes. So we combine these things and we write down what you all know, which is the solution to this. You know, this just becomes our wave equation, right? So there's going to be our linear shallow water wave. I'll pause here just for a second. So, you know, we have a wave equation. We're going to take that to be the solution. Strictly speaking, this is a left-running wave only. We can easily incorporate the right-running wave, and we can superpose them at this order. Okay? So, we solve for u naught. It looks just like that with a negative sign. And then we solve for w from continuity, right? So we have to integrate in z. So even though u depends not on z at leading order, w depends linearly on z at leading order. And maybe one subtlety is, you know, you get a function of integration. So what boundary condition, you know, what are you going to do to say, what are you going to say there? Well, your leading order problem is inviscid. But it's reasonable to say that there's no normal flow down at z equals 0. So when z is 0, if I boldly impose w equals 0, and I guess at this point I didn't know anything had really gone wrong, so I'm like, okay, let's just do that, then f is 0, okay? So, and you can check that this indeed satisfies the leading order kinematic condition, which is that w naught at z equals 1 is d eta naught dt. that works. So it's an eigenvalue problem. Okay, so what's our difficulty? We've did all this hard work, all the preparatory stuff to get to this point where U, you know, does not satisfy the no-slip boundary condition, right? Because it's by fiat, it's only a function of X and T. Okay, but we have reasons that we might care about that bottom boundary because of the energy decay and because of, well, the Reynolds stress driving of a mean flow. Okay, so now we have to, now it's matched asymptotics finally, right? We know where the boundary layer is. It's at z equals zero, and we need to rescale and figure out what is the thickness of the boundary layer, etc. Okay. BL at z equals zero, right? So we would rescale z. And say, as before, that it's delta of epsilon times C. Okay? So there we go. And let's just get the thickness of this layer correct here. So dvdz is 1 on delta dvdc. If we come back to our governing equations, right, what's going to happen here? I mean, we're making an assumption, first of all, that U is still order 1 in the boundary layer. U is 0 at the no-slip boundary, but it jumps up to this value A or something at the edge of the, it's order 1. Okay. So this derivative, it's a Z derivative, it's going to get a 1 on delta squared out front, isn't it? Okay. So we're going to have 1 on Reynolds, delta squared, capital delta squared. Okay. They're all together. And how big do I want that term to be? The dominant balance argument. I want that term to be as big as the local inertia, right? And also the horizontal pressure gradient, both of which are order 1. Okay? So the key point is that I have a term, 1 on REW, delta squared, that I'm going to insist is basically 1. And, you know, so if you're not getting this step, this is the important step, right? I mean, how did I scale, right? It's balancing this term, the pressure gradient, and the diffusion, okay? So when we do that, we now get another relation among our small and big parameters. In some ways, it's easier to think of it as the product delta delta is 1 over square root RE wave, okay? So that's from that. And like, so at this point, we have to make a bit of an arbitrary choice, okay? So the arbitrary choice is that I have to think, how non-hydrostatic am I? I mean, I'm mostly hydrostatic, but how non-hydrostatic? And that's going to, you know, that depends on how I relate these two deltas, okay? These were the equations in the outer region. If I, in fact, we had the pressure, didn't have it over, where did the pressure, oh, I said you could recover. I think I already must have done that here, I'm sorry, is that I chose, if this is a true statement, I chose that delta, that delta, the shallowness parameter, was the square root of this delta, the 2B determined boundary layer thickness. So I already had made that choice, okay? That's not the only choice. But if you want these two terms in the out, you know, if you're bringing in non-hydrostatic effects at this, or then, you know, then that is the choice. Okay? So I made that choice, and then I can put that together here. And we still have some freedom, because I have, you know, if I take this, put it in here, I have a relation between delta and Reynolds, but I still got to get back to epsilon, right? So there's one more choice to be made. And the choice might be motivated, let's see, by, if you look at incompressibility, this guy in the boundary layer, let me just write it next door, dbdx of u plus 1 on delta dbdz w equals, that's not z, that's c. If I do that, right, that's in the boundary layer. Okay, so you might expect to get things to hang together that I'm going to be expanding in the powers of delta.
This is an alternative choice?
No, not alternative choice.
No.
That's what I'm saying. This problem has a lot of small parameters. Sorry. So... I'll back up.
The point about the choice of... Mm-hmm. Okay, delta equals square root of...
This one.
Yes. So what's the physics here?
This is the physics.
This is a question, that
the correction to the pressure, let's go back to our pressure expansion, with some hydrostatics from the background,
yes.
And then here's the wave, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the wave that we have this free surface display. This is part of the pressure field. This does not depend on Z, correct?
Yes.
Right, so it's just uniform pressure because we're so thin.
Yes.
So the physics is at what point in this expansion do you want to say, well, actually the pressure depends not only on X and T, but also on Z. So I am making a choice that it happens here, which when you trace that back, which is why I put this up here, means that it happens here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Sorry. And the other choice that I'm going to make so that I only have epsilon is I'm going to make delta equal to epsilon. Okay? That's yet another choice that's harder to motivate. But that's a choice that when I chase it through and get reduced equations, things seem to hang together in a sensible way. But I admit that one's hard to motivate. So I'm also going to choose delta equal to epsilon. Okay. Now our only small parameter is epsilon, basically. Okay, we need to do a reality check and figure out what we want to do. It's late. So... those of you that know me will know that I will keep talking as long as you sit there and, you know, don't hurl food at me. But I realize I'm unfortunately in the middle of, I have basically, how long will this take?
I continue it next week.
Okay, great. Well, I guess the question is whether you're going to do the Stokes problem or whether you're going to just touch the Stokes problem and then say, and therefore we recognize the...
Yeah, so let me describe what would happen next, yeah. In terms of what I'm prepared to present, if you want to hear. We actually still have to write down, we should write down, I'm doing you a disservice if I don't write down, the boundary layer problem, and we solve it, right? And that's easy, that's not hard, okay? But just because we've done the leading order outer and the leading order inner, the matching is actually easy, that's fine at that order, but you still don't know anything about damping. So that's where the multiple scales aspect comes back into it, is our wave, where was our wave? Here, this A. Really, after the fact, I'm going to let it be A of slow T. But how does that A, you know, where's my equation for that, right? So I actually have to cut this interaction, right? It's a little bit like I've been pumping again. There's a little weak vertical velocity that comes out of the bottom boundary layer, the oscillatory boundary layer, that interacts with the outer flow, okay? So you then go back to do the outer at next order, not order one, but order epsilon, okay? You get a correction to the wave, not because I care about the correction, but if you remember from last week, because I care about solvability, and that will tell me how this A of T behaves. And sure enough, it'll give me a decay timescale. And then we can convince ourselves that it's the right one. But I mean, it gives me the prefactor too, not just, you know, the scaling. Okay? So that's not so hard to do, but there is a little bit of work to put all those pieces together. And then, time permitting, which clearly it's not, I was going to just say, basically in one page, actually, if you keep going and work even a little harder in the boundary layer, you can find out that there is a Reynolds stress divergence that gives you a slip velocity above the Stokes layer that would drive streaming in the interior, albeit on a slower timescale. So that's, you know, I would not give all those details. I mean, I would sketch a few. For that streaming part, I was just going to say, here are the key things and here's what you find. Isn't that cool? That's why we shouldn't just neglect, you know, even laminar boundary. Like, I mean, you shouldn't just neglect them. They can have important physical consequences. But clearly that's way too much for, you know.
You know. If you don't mind presuming next week, we have these wave people coming in.
Yeah.
So that might be a really nice match.
Okay. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I apologize. This is sort of an awkward spot to stop, but I know people are hungry and tired.
It is.
Okay. See you.
Cool.